Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network, a station dedicated to the concept that all manifestations of the divine are equally valid. Join Reverend Terry Power HP, Robin McKean, and all the hosts for programming covering a wide range of spiritual topics right here on Blog Talk Radio.
To an emerging forest, a safe place where we have the freedom to think about life without judgment. We take a look at society, we examine it, and we allow for the possibility of something new, something different. And now, here's your host, Alan Ritter.
Well, good evening, folks, and welcome to another episode of An Emerging Forest. And this week, I'm very fortunate to have Leslie Bean, who's a professional gardener and someone who's in the horticulture area. She's owned her own business for many years, and she's here to talk about spring clean gardening and yard tasks. So, hi, Leslie. How are you?
Hi, I'm good, Alan. How are you?
Good. So
good. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for being on. How did you get, what was your path to where you are now, sort of in a nutshell?
Yeah, definitely in a nutshell, because it's a winding path. So I've been in horticulture for over 25 years. I started when I was in high school and college on spring breaks and winter breaks, summer. I would work in greenhouses and, various horticultural jobs. I went to college for art history and fine art and have a degree in both. And when I graduated college, needed a job, and I started to work at an art gallery part-time, but needed, more of a full-time employment. So I ended up getting a job at a local greenhouse, and very quickly within my job there, which was shipping or something fairly simple, I was invited to learn, the skill of growing plants, and I became a grower. And then from that point on, worked at other greenhouses, various sizes and wholesale, retail, learned how to grow shrubs, vegetables, annuals, perennials, pretty much everything. And from that point, ended up working at florists and for landscapers, for other gardeners, and eventually started my own business in 2004. And go ahead.
Go ahead. No, my business just, it's just interesting.
it is. A lot of people, though, go to school for art and, don't do anything directly related to the exact field, but do something artistically related. And, gardening definitely is artistic in many ways. So the name of my business is Dirty Girl Gardening. And like I said, I started my business in 2004. It was started under a different name, but that is the new name. And I have a website, dirtygirlgardeners.com, and we're also on Facebook and Instagram. And what else can I tell you about what I do now?
I think you've covered it. I'd just like to encourage our audience, if they're interested in talking directly to you about spring cleanup tasks, that our call-in number is 646-564-9714. So you sort of put together a laundry list of the big projects to do, the big projects to leave weight, and then how to do those big projects the way you think they should be done. And
right.
You just want to launch into that with which project comes first now.
Sure. I should say, first of all, I forgot to mention that we are 100% organic, which is ultimately why I feel like I have a worthwhile message to get across, you know, in the world of horticulture and gardening and landscaping. We are organic. It's very important. I take every opportunity I can to educate clients, friends, Facebook community, and total strangers on the importance of organic gardening. I should specify also that what we do at Dirty Girl Gardening is not totally all encompassing. We kind of have a niche with what we do, and we do container gardening, and that's seasonal, you know, sort of artistic, creative creation of container gardening. We do property maintenance, which would consist of spring and fall cleanups and, you know, garden bed maintenance, weeding, pruning, deadheading, fertilizing, that sort of thing. And then we do garden design and installation. And that's sort of the extent to what we do. We don't do any lawn care. I don't consider myself a landscaper. You know, I'm truly a fine gardener, very, very attention to detail, and perfectionistic about the quality of work that we do. We take the time to do things in a horticulturally sound manner rather than, you know, the, you know, quote unquote blow and go of the landscapers, where they kind of chop things and run their blower and then move on to the next job. So before I get into the details of the spring cleanup, I just wanted to clarify that, you know, this is coming from an organic point of view and also a horticulturist point of view, not the typical landscaper's to-do list.
Yeah, that's very. I can testify that you're very attention to detail. Having been out with you for one day, it happened to be a really fun day that was well over. I mean, I estimate it was well over 100 degrees with the heat index. And you and I both. Thank goodness that there was a pool there. Everyone was very unself-conscious, just in walking and dropping into the pool.
I believe that.
So if
you're ready, I'll get into. Okay, so a spring cleanup. You know, part of the reason there are so many things that I could talk about, but part of the reason I wanted to bring up spring cleanup and really get into the details and the importance of organics is that that's what everybody's concerned with right now. You know, what is a typical spring cleanup? Well, you know, you've left your gardens all winter. In some cases, many people choose to leave ornamental grasses and seed heads on perennials up all winter, you know, to feed the birds and other critters, to give them shelter, or just because they like the look. So either way, whether you've clear cut your perennials, or whether you've got beds that are, you know, still have quite a few plants standing, it's basically time for a spring cleanup. And what's involved in a spring cleanup is typically a general bed cleanup, pruning, applying a fertilizer, optional applying a pre-emergent, which helps to control weeds, re-edging beds, and then putting down a mulch. So that's what we're going to talk about piece by piece.
Great. Sounds interesting.
Okay. So for a general cleanup, which is first, and I'm going through this in the steps that we would usually take to to do this process and get the beds under control. So in the general cleanup, you know, you want to start with cleaning up the beds. That includes weeding. And there's a surprising number of weeds that are already out there. There are weeds that tend to grow in cooler weather. So you'll see them come up in spring, disappear through most of the summer, and then come back again in fall. So you've already got those early weeds out there. And basically nobody wants weeds in their flower beds. You know, there are some people, though, who appreciate weeds. Technically, you know, we like to call them weeds, but technically they are medicinal, edible, herbal, you know, beneficial in some way. Those could be weeds like dandelions, plantain, purslane, lamb's quarters, chickweed, things like that, you know, are technically beneficial in some way if you know about them. So I do actually have clients who ask us to leave certain things in their beds, but for the most part, we want to weed out everything else, get things neatened up. We always pull weeds by the root. I actually had a client today email me asking as part of an estimate that I had sent if we pull weeds by the root. And I laughed and I said, you know, what a great, I responded and said, what a great scam that would be for job security to just kind of, you know, cut the head off and leave the root in the ground. it seemed really comical to me to ask that, you know, but to me, it's just, you know, we pull weeds by the root. So I should put that out there that is important, you know, not just to kind of slice it off at the top, but to try to get it by the root. We use a tool called a hori hori, H-O-R-I, and it's also referred to as a weeding knife. I used to use a common garden trowel, but the hori hori has proven to be an amazing tool. So if you don't know about that, you might want to check one out. They're pretty much indestructible. Okay, so along with weeding, you want to remove leaves from beds. And what you want to think about is if you're planning to apply a mulch, you typically don't need to remove every last little bit of leaf matter because you're going to be covering it up with mulch. And whatever, you know, small little pieces of leaves or small layer of leaves will ultimately break down beneath the mulch and add nutrients to the soil. It is important, however, to get the large clumps of leaves out of the beds. We also take the time to remove leaves from within shrubs, large clumps of leaves that are piled under shrubs. Not only does it achieve a much cleaner look, but ultimately it prevents excess moisture from building up and, you know, causing mold or rot within a shrub. So a lot of landscapers kind of blow what they can out of shrubs and trees, and whatever's left, they just leave. But it's actually valuable to take the time to pick out, you know, the clumps of leaves. Now, eventually, when we get to mulching, I'm going to talk about the use of leaf mulch or leaf compost as a mulch. So, you know, this may sound like I'm sort of contradictory here, but you don't really want to use leaves that aren't really broken down as a mulch. Plus, they'll blow around. You know, they won't really serve the purpose. And if there are too big of clumps throughout the bed, they will end up smothering things. So this time of year, you're better off removing the large clumps of leaves. And if you want to make your own leaf mulch, you can do that. The leaves should be shredded, stored in a bin, like a wire bin, for about a year or so and aged, and then can be used as a mulch. So people often ask me, you know, what am I doing by pulling the leaves out of the bed when I'm, you know, a little bit later in the process putting down leaf mulch? But there is a difference between leaf compost and, you know, fresh leaves that are in a bed.
Yeah, so basically what you're doing, you're removing leaves. Those leaves are going to basically sit there and go through a rotting process, and in that rotting process, you're going to imperil your plantings, where you might want to come back after the leaves have rotted down and put the same thing back in, but you don't want to attract the fungus or the mold, right?
Exactly. And leaves naturally, you know, if you had a layer of leaf litter in your beds and you just left it exactly as it was from the fall, it tends to, you know, the leaves tend to not really break down very quickly, and they almost form like this solid layer, you know, where they're not shredded. So it's just a solid layer, and it can get very mucky and moldy and thick and dense, whereas leaf compost or leaf mulch is already shredded. It's pre-shredded, rototilled, and turned into it's in a bit more of a decomposed state when you put it down. So it's got more to give to your beds and less chance,
right,
of, you know, any sort of damage by sitting on perennials or anything like that.
Right. It's much more permeable, right?
Exactly. So the next part of a general bed cleanup would be cutting back any ornamental grasses or perennials. A lot of people like to leave up ornamental grasses through the winter. They offer great winter interest. Perennials do as well. You know, it's kind of, I sort of have to fight with people to get them to leave seed heads up, whether it's, you know, echinacea, coneflower, or Rudbeckia or something like that. You know, everybody likes a nice clean slate going into the winter, but there is a lot of beauty in leaving seed heads and ornamental grasses up. So at this point in the season, it's time for a fresh start and to cut these things back. So to cut down ornamental grasses, you know, those big, fluffy, giant grasses, we use gas-powered hedge trimmers, and it allows a very quick, even cut. Another trick is to bungee the top of the grass, which might sound crazy. You sort of bungee a loop around it, and then that way, once the grass is cut, you can carry it away in a big mass, and there's no mess. And whatever you do, don't cut grasses on a windy day, because the pieces will be everywhere. Just a side note, as far as the ornamental grasses go, if after you cut them, you notice that the center of the grasses is missing and it's turned into what looks like a large ring of grasses, that means it's probably time to divide the grass into smaller sections. So you'd want to dig up the entire thing, maybe cut it into four quadrants, and then replant, or possibly just throw out the other sections if you can't use them. That just signifies that it's time to divide. And then, like I mentioned, you know, with the seed heads from perennials, you want to cut those back. Many people cut perennials all the way down to the ground. I like to leave, you know, maybe a few inches of a stem showing, just so that you can see where things are. And then in addition is trimming or cutting down ground covers. And not all ground covers, but there's a few that benefit from a fresh cut. One of those is liriope, which is a grass-like spreading ground cover, and it gets little flowers in the summer with a little purple, and eventually gets like a dark purple or black berry kind of little thing on its stem in the fall. And so in the winter, liriope gets kind of straw-like, sort of beat up, brown, you know, the edge is frayed, and it's time to cut back. However, usually when someone has liriope, they have got a sea of it. So we're not talking, you know, a little 2x2 patch. We're talking an entire bed of liriope. And we have tried over the years many different techniques. I've heard from, you know, some other gardeners that they use lawnmowers or weed whackers. People are desperate to find, you know, a good method to cut this liriope down. If anybody has ideas, I would love to hear them, because we've tried everything. We just end up cutting it by hand with our hand pruners. Liriope needs to be cut back. I've had some clients, you know, attempt to leave it and let the fresh stuff come up, the fresh growth come through it, and it just kind of looks messy, because you never really get rid of that straw-like beat up, you know, grass that lasted through the winter. And it doesn't actually turn to straw and just float away. It stays there, and it looks, has a, you know, sort of a dead look to it. another ground cover that you'd want to cut back that a lot of people don't realize benefits from a cutback is zinca, otherwise known as periwinkle. And what we do is we grab the long, loose tendrils and we cut them back very hard. So we're cutting almost where they're coming out of the ground. And that actually promotes a ton of new growth and flowering. So that's a little secret there. And then, of course, fertilizing, you know, helps to give all of these things that you've cut back a little push to grow and flower. And I think the last part that I'm going to talk about, and we can get into this in more detail if we have time later, but another part of just the general bed cleanup is pruning. And there are lots of things that you can prune starting in spring. Many of them you can get a head start actually in late winter, more like February or early March, depending on the weather. So one of the methods of pruning this time of year is called rejuvenation pruning. And I'll give you an example of what we're trying to achieve with rejuvenation pruning. Boxwoods. So everybody hopefully knows what boxwoods are. They are one of the most common shrubs that's hedged, turned into a hedgerow, or shaped into, you name it, you know, whether it's you shape it into a square, a circle, or a kitty cat. You can shape it into anything. Other shrubs that are commonly used as hedges would be privet, things like that. Use boxwoods and privet, typically turned into hedges or shaped. So you take something like a boxwood that's being turned into a hedge, and what are you doing? Ultimately, you're cutting this shrub to the same height, because that you have a height, a desired height, and you're cutting it to that same height over and over and over, year after year. That's your desired height. So that's where this shrub is being cut. Well, you know, as you can imagine, that puts a great deal of stress on the plant. And we've all probably driven down the road, looked in someone's yard, looked alongside the road, and you've seen boxwoods that look like they've been, I don't know, set on fire and are absolutely fried on top. You see wood, you see, you know, that yellowish brown on the top. Just looks like it's been through a fire. So the problem is that, you know, that's a sign that landscapers or the homeowners have been repeatedly cutting them to the same height year after year and have never done any rejuvenation pruning. So rejuvenation pruning on boxwoods is also known as plunge pruning. And the goal of that is to encourage new healthy growth from deep within the shrub. So you're making these holes in the shrub. You're taking out sections of the growth all over the plant. From far away, you can't tell that this has been done. From up close, you can see holes all over the place. And you're allowing sunlight to penetrate deeper into the shrub and allow new growth to come up. And that is really only way to get shrubs that you want to shape year after year to have longevity and to keep going. You know, the typical landscaper who's pruning things like that will end up eventually having to dig them out and plant new shrubs. And maybe that's their goal, job security again. But ultimately that's not the way that you want to care for these things. So rejuvenation pruning should be done in spring. Spring has a big push of growth. You're fertilizing. Great time to do rejuvenation pruning. There are a lot of shrubs and trees that would benefit from it, not just things that are being cut into hedges or shapes. another part of our spring pruning is plants that we all know, Buddleia, otherwise known as butterfly bush, Vitex, which is known as chaste tree, similar to a butterfly bush in flowering. Roses, spirea, these are shrubs that respond well to a nice hard cut. And by hard cut, I mean taking about a third to a half of their size off. Many landscapers who don't really know when to cut these will cut these in fall because it kind of adds to the, you know, the overall look of that very clean, you know, the yard is cleaned up, everything's cut back, everything's tightly put to bed for the winter. You can cut a little bit off of these shrubs in the fall, but ideally you do the hard cut in the spring. And the reason that you want to do that is that the cuts that you'd be making in the fall will leave these plants, leave the cuts open and susceptible to winter damage and dieback. So you want to always wait to prune things like butterfly bush, rose bushes, and spirea for the spring. And the last piece of pruning information that I'm going to give you as part of a spring cleanup, and this is an important one that most people have never heard of, everybody has these shrubs in their yard, is the thinning of what you could call cane shrubs. These are things like forsythia, spirea, quince, caria. These are shrubs that produce growth from the ground up, sending up multiple stems, what we call cane, rather than, you know, a few branches, a few main branches that branch off into other smaller branches. It basically looks like a jumble of sticks coming up from the ground. Picture a forsythia, what a very full forsythia looks like. Those are cane shrubs. So, you know, in addition to the rejuvenation pruning, thinning cane shrubs extends longevity, keeps them going. And the way that you want to do that is to prune about a third of the oldest, thickest canes as low to the ground as possible. So when I say take a third off, you're considering the third in an opposite way that you would the rejuvenation pruning. In rejuvenation pruning, or you know, in the pruning of, for example, the butterfly bush, when I say you can take a third off of a butterfly bush, you're literally cutting it, you know, a third down from the top and on all the sides. Whereas when you're thinning something and I say take a third, I'm not saying take a third off, I'm saying take a third out, you're removing the canes entirely. So you're cutting it as low to the ground as possible, making room for new growth to push up. And the oldest canes in this case typically are either a dark brown or almost a gray, whereas the new growth tends to be a light brown or a green. So those are kind of more generalized tips that I can give for spring pruning rather than, you know, go through each shrub. Everybody has the shrubs that could use a hard cutback like spirea, and everybody has cane shrubs that could benefit from cutting about a third of the canes out. Alan.
Wow.
That's
really great, because everybody has those plants in their yard, and everybody's going to benefit from that better understanding of how quote unquote drastic some of these spring prunings are. And this is actually timing.
I was going to say, in some cases, people can be, you know, almost shocked by how drastically you can cut these things. But in the end, you know, within a few months, they are lush and, you know, back in business. But this is the time where you can cut these things harder, and they will benefit from it and spring back.
Great. Well, that's a great first half of the show. And I'd like to play a song here and take a break. So the song I'm going to introduce is Darv the Bard, Bonnie Black Hair. Back after the break. See ya.
On the 14th of May, at the dawn of the day, with me gone on his shoulder to the woods I did stray, in search of some game, if the weather proved fair, to see if I could get a shot at the Bonnie Black Hair. Well, I met a girl there with a face as a rose. Her skin was as pale as the lily that glows. I said, now, young maiden, why We'll both go again and hug the bonny black
to International Pagan Radio. You can hear your favorite artists such as Dave the Bard, Tuatha Dea, Spiral Rhythm, S.J. Tucker, Murphy's Midnight Rounders, and many, many more. Join us for exciting shows like Ask a Witch and Storytime with Rook as well. www.internationalpaganradio.com on the net or on TuneIn Radio on your mobile devices. Join us on Facebook and Twitter too. International Pagan Radio, all pagan, all the time.
Welcome back to An Emerging Forest on the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. We hope everyone was able to stretch their legs and get a drink. And now, back to Alan.
Well, welcome back, everybody. And let's continue with this great information that we're getting from Leslie about what to do in the spring. We've heard about bed cleanup. We've heard a lot of very interesting details about pruning. So what's next, Leslie?
Well, on the second half of the hour, I'm really going to get into the importance of organics. I didn't really get into any of that in the first half. And I know that you in particular know a lot about these things. You were actually, as you recall, a guest on the radio show that I was co-host of for over 2 years, called Into the Garden, and we talked about Roundup, you know, and the harmful effects of Roundup. So I'm going to be talking about the last few pieces of a fall cleanup, fertilization, use of a pre-emergent, and mulching. So let's dig right into fertilization. Most people understand that fertilization of all of our plants, trees, shrubs, perennials, ground covers, should be done twice a year, ideally, in spring and fall. Regular fertilization will increase vigor and flowering, and that's something everybody wants. So what is fertilizer? Fertilizer is defined as any substance used to add nutrients to the soil to promote soil fertility and increase plant growth. Not all fertilizers are the same, and not all are healthy for the soil. And ultimately, it is healthy soil which leads to healthy plants. So we really need to take good care of our soil. Now, soil health relies on a balance of macro and micronutrients. And I'm not going to get into details that will probably bore everyone. I'll get into the important parts. As a business, we use only organic fertilizers. Chemical fertilizers can cause many problems, not only for the beds where they're used, but for the nearby ecosystems and people's well water, their pets, et cetera. We'll talk about chemical fertilizers first and why we don't want them. A big issue with chemical fertilizer is groundwater contamination. Most chemical fertilizers are water soluble, and that means that they remain in the groundwater for decades. There's a study at the University of Wisconsin, and they found that the effects of chemical fertilizers are compounded when mixed with a single pesticide. So if you look at the typical, whether it's agriculture, a farm, or just the average person's yard, you know, the typical family is not only using chemical fertilizer everywhere on their property, on their lawn, in their beds, on their trees, and then you compound it, as this study showed, with a pesticide, an herbicide, an insecticide, and you get, you know, an even bigger problem. They discovered altered immune, endocrine, and nervous system functions in mice, as well as an influence on children and fetuses developing systems. So, you know, there's lots of proof that chemical fertilizers, pesticides, are having a detrimental effect on us, on animals, and on our environment. Groundwater contamination has also been linked to gastric, testicular, and stomach cancer, birth malformations, hypertension, and other diseases. With fertilizers increased use and projections for future use, this problem may increase several fold. Knowing and understanding the effects really doesn't do us much good without you know, a willingness to take action on our part and to make a change. It's a big reason why I make sure that all of my clients understand why we only use organic products, and I especially stress that if they have well water or live near a water source. You know, I know clients who live with a stream on their property, with a pond. I have many clients that live along the Delaware River, and sadly, they do not realize that it's their responsibility, you know, to do the right thing for the environment until I bring it to their attention. And then, you know, luckily they appreciate it from that point forward. So chemical fertilizers, I'll sort of summarize this so that you can understand this without going into much more detail. Chemical fertilizers, for example, when used on a lawn, only serve as a Band-Aid that requires constant application to achieve its results. The chemicals are slowly killing off all of the biotics in the soil, ultimately creating more and more of a need for more fertilizer to achieve the desired result. Organic fertilizers are doing the exact opposite, building healthy soil, which ultimately decreases the need for it year after year. So again, chemical fertilizer, the more you use it, the more it's killing the soil, increasing the need for it. Whereas organic fertilizers are doing the exact opposite. They're building healthy soil. Once the soil gets to the point where it's very healthy on its own, you need less and less fertilizer. It takes a little bit longer to achieve that, but obviously, you know, you save money in the end going organic. So that brings us to talk about organic fertilizer. What are organic fertilizers? They come from plant, animal, or mineral sources. In order to qualify as organic, the materials must occur naturally in nature. And fertilizer for organic gardening isn't, as I described, the quick fix that chemical fertilizers are. Organics, you have to let the moisture and beneficial organisms break down the content of the fertilizer. So you're waiting a little bit longer for the desired result, but in the end, it's more beneficial. In my company, we've used many brands of organic fertilizers over the years to be absolutely sure that they're organic. They should have the lettering OMRI on the bag, and that stands for Organic Materials Review Institute, and that ensures that they're 100% organic. I know there are a lot of products out there that say organic on the bag that are actually not organic. So you want to look for the OMRI label. We've used, I'll just mention a couple brands. We've used Sustain. It's spelled S-U-S-T-A-N-E, and that's a great product. It's made from aerobically composted turkey litter combined with other plant nutrients and soil amending ingredients, and it's a granular fertilizer. The organic nitrogen is released slowly to the plant, minimizing loss to the environment. Again, that slow release, taking a little bit longer, ultimately better for the soil, for the plants. Little is lost in runoff, you know, into the yard, into nearby streams. Another brand that we use is Earthworks, and that's actually based in Easton, Pennsylvania, so that's fairly local. Those fertilizers are designed to maximize the microbial activity of the soil. Made with mineral-rich poultry compost, the byproducts of biological digestion from the poultry, brings a host of benefits, which are increased enzymes, amino acids, and minerals. These benefits are not found in compound commercial fertilizers or chemical fertilizers, and in some cases, not even in organic fertilizers. Not all organic or natural fertilizers are poultry-based. So when you find something like this, it's got benefits that other fertilizers actually do not. Earthworks is a fertilizer that I'm going to be switching to for the most part sooner than later. And then, of course, there's other methods of fertilizing. You know, there's choosing the right mulch. A mulch, you know, ideally contributes nutrients to the beds. There's using compost or aged manure around your plants. So there's many ways to fertilize organically. I think that's pretty much it for fertilizer to touch on the important parts, which brings us to a pre-emergent. A lot of people don't really know what a pre-emergent is. A pre-emergent that we probably have all heard of is preen. Preen is chemical. Another version of a chemical pre-emergent is snapshot. Those are very commonly used by landscapers. What a pre-emergent does is it acts on the weed seeds. So when you spread it in a flower bed, it's preventing weed seeds from germinating by drying out the seed as soon as it's cracked open to sprout. So it's not killing actual living weeds. It's not killing plants. It's strictly acting on weed seeds, which is why it's called a pre-emergent. Weed seeds, you know, come, you've had a thistle weed in your garden and you don't pull it in time and it flowers and the flower turns to seed. And then the wind blows and the seeds are everywhere and they're in what you would call a seed bank in the soil for years and years. Weed seeds can always blow from the neighbor's yard, from nearby farms. Even if you don't have a ton of weeds, there are likely tons of weed seeds in your beds, you know, just waiting to come up. So a pre-emergent helps. I can't say that it's foolproof. It does help in keeping weeds down. So for people with very large yards, large beds, you know, large areas of perennials and, you know, very lush gardens. A pre-emergent is a good idea because it adds a little bit extra help, but it's not foolproof. So my version of a pre-emergent, which is an organic alternative to preen or snapshot, would be corn gluten. And corn gluten is organic, it's 100% natural, and it's a byproduct of the corn milling process. It's a natural protein, and it's very effective for lawns and gardens as a plant food, as well as a weed suppressor. It's very high in nitrogen, and when used on a lawn, it acts kind of as a weed and feed. It offers a non-toxic yet effective alternative method to the, you know, traditional chemical-based weed and feed products. Another thing I should mention is it does not inhibit roots or mature plants or transplants unless it's used at a very high rate. So you would literally have to dump it near a mature plant, on top of a mature plant or a transplant, or at root level to really do some damage. So it's you could even sprinkle it on other plants lightly and it wouldn't hurt anything. And it's most active when it gets wet. So it's kind of ideal to spread in spring, you know, with the spring rains. That brings us to, briefly before I get into mulching, I'll just mention the edging of beds. I think a lot of people understand that getting a nice, clean edge around your beds, creating that delineation between lawn and bed is not only aesthetically pleasing, looks nice and clean and sharp, but it also helps to hold back mulch from either in a rain or, you know, with wind, kind of blending right into the lawn and creating a mess when you go to cut the grass. So before we mulch, we always edge the beds, and we use a flat edging shovel to do that, keeping our edging shovel very sharp. Okay, so mulch. This is a big deal. Everybody has seen all different kinds of mulches, I'm sure. There's hardwood mulch, there's licorice root mulch, there are dyed mulches, there's pine bark mulch, there's pine needle mulch, leaf mulch, so many. So do we all know what the purpose of mulch is, though? Probably not. People spend tons of money in the spring on yards and yards and yards of mulch to tidy up their beds. Question is it worth it? You can create what we call a green mulch just by using plants to fill the bed so tightly, whether it's with ground covers or perennials, that that you ultimately don't need the mulch. But until you get there, what purpose does mulch serve? It serves a few. It helps to suppress weeds, which I think is the obvious one that everybody thinks of. It also helps to maintain soil temperature and to hold in moisture into the bed. So often, if you don't have mulch on a bed, you'll see the bed starts to crack and kind of look like a desert. It also heats up very quickly, in turn heating the roots of the plants in your bed. So two very important things there, maintaining soil temperature and holding moisture. Mulch should ideally decompose slowly, and as it decomposes, it should add nutrients to the soil, thus fertilizing the plants. And then, obviously, in the end, it creates a nice sort of finished look to the beds. So a new thing over the past, I don't know how many years, 10 years or so, is dyed mulch. And dyed mulch is typically black, brown, or a red, orangish color, which is pretty bad. And I'm not really sure where this originated or why. The black mulch, I think, is because people tend to have this idea that, you know, the darker the better. They need their beds black. Black equals, you know, status. It equals health. Black mulch is ideal. Well, you know, that's in nature, it's sort of exactly the opposite. First of all, there aren't really black things in nature. You know, there are rich, you know, the forest floor is a rich, deep brown. You just don't find that sort of thing in nature. So let's get into the reasons why we don't want to use dyed mulch, aside from the fact that it just looks unnatural. So dyed mulches are hardwood mulch. The mulch needs something to adhere, I mean, the dye needs something to adhere to. So wood mulch is ideal to dye. However, you know, we'd all like to think that, you know, I do a pruning job or, you know, a tree guy takes down a tree, takes it to the dump chips it up into little pieces, and that becomes your mulch. Well, while that's partially true, the majority of hardwood mulch actually comes from recycled wood waste. This could be trash wood, such as hardwood pallets, old decking, wood from demolished buildings, and worse yet, pressure-treated lumber, which contains CCA, that stands for chromium, copper, and arsenic. Regular composted tree shrub debris does not hold the dye as well as the trash wood. So the majority of the time that you're getting dyed mulch, you can be pretty sure that you're getting these other materials, because natural tree and shrub debris does not hold the dye. So the dyed wood does not break down to enrich the soil, as we talked about mulch should do. Instead, it leaches the dye along with the contaminants, which could be, you know, the arsenic, into the soil, harming or killing the beneficial soil bacteria. Along with that, it's also harming or killing insects, earthworms, and sometimes the plants themselves. Hardwood mulches, in general, regardless of dyed or not, actually rob the soil of nitrogen by out-competing the plants that they surround, that the mulch surrounds, for the nitrogen that they need for their own growth. Dyed mulches are especially deadly when they're used around young plants or in newer landscapes, because the plants are younger and, you know, maybe struggling anyway to establish themselves. So that's an important point. Hardwood mulch, as it breaks down, needs nitrogen for the decomposition process. And where does it get that nitrogen? It gets the nitrogen from the soil. So it's stealing the nitrogen from your plants to break down. Whereas, as I mentioned previously, ideally a mulch should break down and add nitrogen to the soil, not take it away. So I tend to steer clear of dyed mulch, definitely, but also hardwood mulch because of that. The other issue is that and regular hardwood mulch decompose at a much slower rate than leaf mulch, let's say. The previous year's mulch layer has not decomposed into the soil, leaving inches of mulch layers intact. And if a landscaper goes in from year to year and doesn't sweep away some of the old mulch and just adds to it, within a very, you know, within a few years, you've got a mountain of mulch. And with the dyed mulch in particular, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, it gets a fungus where you can actually pick up black dyed mulch in giant, like, puzzle pieces, like slabs,
and it just
holds together, which is disgusting. So, you know, obviously, that should give you a clue that that's bad stuff. So that brings me to the fact that, you know, this type of mulch is highly susceptible to unwanted fungus. The one in particular that I was just talking about is a white, kind of string-like fungus that grows underneath the mulch, holding it together in large chunks. It can also attach itself to trunks and roots of trees and shrubs. Another fungus that probably everybody has seen in hardwood mulch but maybe didn't quite understand is artillery fungus. A big problem in hardwood mulch in general, especially black dyed mulch. It's a white rotting, wood decay fungus that likes to live in moist mulch. It's called artillery fungus because it shoots its spores towards sunlight to aid in the dispersal of the spores. It literally, like artillery, shoots the spores all over. It's particularly attracted to white surfaces, although it will hit, and more noticeable, obviously, on white surfaces, but it will shoot, you know, all over. You know, imagine that you have mulch all around your house and you have a white or beige siding. Well, if you look closely, there are little black dots everywhere on the house. It can even hit a car if a car's nearby, and they're very, very difficult to remove. I've never seen artillery fungus in a leaf mulch. This is pretty strict, you know, with the hardwood mulches. And that brings us to what mulch should we use? There are a few that aren't bad. Although my favorite is probably leaf mulch. We use a great deal of leaf mulch. It's 100% natural. When you first spread it, it has a nice, dark, rich brown color. No additives to achieve that color. Over time, you know, it can fade a little bit, but it can, with a little fluffing, with a leaf rake or something like that, you get the color right back. Now, leaf mulch, as opposed to hardwood mulch, breaks down completely over the course of one season to enrich the soil. So whereas hardwood mulch, you know, you put down a layer, a few inches of black dyed mulch, you're literally waiting years for it to break down. Leaf mulch breaks down in one season. It increases the soil's organic content. It aids in beneficial soil bacteria and enhances earthworm production. And my crew, probably horrified sometimes, can attest to that one, because we have never seen earthworms like the worms that we've seen in clients that have strictly used leaf mulch for years. Leaf mulch being composted or naturally aged releases nitrogen, helping rather than harming the biotics of the soil. People can make their own leaf mulch, as I mentioned earlier. You know, you have a lot of leaf drop in your yard in the fall. That's your own raw material for making leaf mulch. A way to do it quickly and easily: run it over with a lawnmower, put it in a pot, you know, kind of rake it into small piles, run it over a few times with a lawnmower. Some people have shredding leaf blowers that you can put them into. Create like a chicken wire bin, either a square bin or a round area, and dump the shredded leaves, you know, just keep piling them inside the wire bin. Every once in a while, you can turn the pile. You maybe leave it all winter. In the spring, you can turn it a few times. You could even put a small rototiller in it. Just kind of flip it over, churn it up a little bit. leave it for about a year, and then makes beautiful leaf mulch to be used the next year. However, you need a lot of leaves to mulch most beds, a lot of leaf mulch. So you're going to have to make a ton to, you know, to do 5 yards or so of mulching. The other thing about leaf mulch is that it should be applied quite thick. Typically, hardwood mulch gets applied at about 2 to 3 inches, again, because it's not decomposing. It's not really going anywhere for a long time, so you don't want it to smother your plants. Leaf mulch, on the other hand, should be applied somewhere around 4 or 6 inches. It seems very thick at first, but it's not actually going to harm trees or shrubs. You know, it's just loose leaf matter. Like you had said earlier, it's not dense. You know, it's kind of porous. And what it does, when you put it down that thick, it compacts on itself, and it forms a nice thick layer and kind of solidifies, not in the sense that the black-dyed mulch becomes, you know, a puzzle piece you can pick up, but in the sense that it you need a lot so that it compacts on itself and makes a solid layer. If you use much less, you know, because it decomposes so rapidly, by June you'll have nothing left. So the thicker the better. And
so
that's pretty much my. Go ahead, sorry.
It's kind of interesting to think of the cartoon that you were talking about with the earthworms, because the earthworms actually, once they get used to this steady diet of leaf compost, they're going to actually be like the whales, and they're going to come up and grab a leaf and pull it down with them into the soil.
I'll tell you,
and
that is practically what they do.
Well, I was kind of not kidding, because sometimes I watch these vermiculture compost programs, and what they do is they have their worms living in a you know, maybe a 3-inch soil layer, and then they put down, you know, some leaf litter on top, and those worms just come right up and snag those leaves and pull them under.
Right. Yeah, I really should video it one day. It's incredible.
Yeah, you should have your own interesting or dirty girl YouTube channel, right?
Right. Yeah. All the bizarre natural things we experience. So that is pretty much it. I briefly wanted to touch on, if we have time, horticultural vinegar, which we use as an organic alternative to Roundup. Everybody by this point hopefully knows, you know, how harmful and cancer-causing something like Roundup is, glyphosate, the main ingredient. I think a lot of people have heard of the household mixture that you can come up with, which consists of, you know, regular vinegar that you would use in a salad, a white vinegar typically mixed with Epsom salt and dish soap. And a lot of people have said that they've had, you know, a decent amount of success with that. However, to really get the full benefit of using vinegar as an herbicide or a weed killer, you want to use a 20 or 30% vinegar or acidity. Again, 20 or 30%
wow.
vinegar, as opposed to common household vinegar, which is only 5%. So 20 or 30%, especially 30%, can actually, you know, be corrosive to your skin, but it kills the heck
very
out of weeds.
So.
And it works best, you know, if you apply it on a sunny, warm day, a dry day when it's not going to rain. And because of how it kills, it will kill or damage nearby plants. So when you apply it, you would want to apply pretty much the same as you would a Roundup. You wouldn't spray Roundup on wanted plants. So you want to be very careful when spraying something like a 30% vinegar. And you know, a little plug for myself is that I'm actually going to be selling my own horticultural vinegar this year. I'm having the labels in production right now, and it'll be available on my website merchandise page. But you know, I'm really pushing the alternative products to the typical chemicals that everybody knows and that fill the end caps, you know, at hardwood stores and box stores. You know, that's all we see. That's all we know. So we think they're safe, and they're really not. So, I'm a big sort of environmental activist and advocate, and so I figure if I get my own product out there and really promote the heck out of horticultural vinegar, you know, that'll sway people's thinking.
Yeah, I'm as you know from having been in the same room and been on the charge on that Roundup program. I'm not a big fan of of Roundup either, especially since 80 milliliter or about a 3 or 4 ounce dosage to an adult sized person requires immediate medical attention, and there have been some cases of death at that level of dosage. So It isn't really quote unquote safe as water, which the lobbyists and Monsanto would have you believe. So
exactly.
This has really been a great hour on some really pertinent topics of how to do it right, what some of the more detailed information on pruning and bed maintenance and plant maintenance in general, and what some our alternatives are in the fertilizer area and why you want to use them as far as growing soil fertility. And my program in Emerging Forest is all about growing fertility at all levels, and this is just another level to grow fertility at. So could you give your contact information again so that everybody hears it?
Yes. So my website is www.dirtygirlgardeners, that's with an S, gardeners.com. I'm on Facebook at Dirty Girl Gardening with Leslie Bean and on Instagram at Dirty Girl Gardeners. And before you know, we sign off here, I just want to, you know, kind of leave you with a takeaway message that, you know, we're sort of used to thinking that what we do in our yard, you know, in this little micro bubble, this little, you know, environment of our yard, our garden, our home, that what we do is our business. It's our business. It's none of my neighbor's business. It's my business. And that there are no real consequences for what we do on our own properties. But that's a falsehood, and you know what we do on a small scale, you know, has much larger consequences than we like to think. You know, we're all surrounded by creeks and streams and rivers, and we have well water. We're also surrounded by other creatures, great and small, whether a bluebird, our pet dog, our children, or our neighbors, or ourselves. And we need to, you know, really start to show respect for the planet and its inhabitants, and understand that what we do in our own yards on a small scale ultimately contributes to the local environment and then beyond that to the planet. So, I feel like I, as a gardener providing a service, has a huge responsibility to make that change and to do the right thing, you know, for the local environment and for the planet. And it's sort of disappointing that other landscapers, I see it as a huge missed opportunity on their part to not further their own education and learn and spread the word with their clients and with the public. I'm doing it, and I talk to anybody I meet, whether it's in a garden center or a hardwood store or a grocery store. You know, I try to spread the word about taking some responsibility for our actions. And if we all do that, and, you know, if we all learn something from the organic alternatives that I suggested today, and we make those changes in our own yard, you know, and then tell our friends and neighbors about it, you know, imagine the change that we alone could make.
Amen to that. I'm in the produce business, and I do it every day.
Yeah,
Thank you so much for being on the show. Maybe I'll have you on again sometime in the future if things go if things it pops up again. And
yeah, that would be great.
Thank you so much. Just like to let everyone know who I am again. I'm Alan Ritter. My email address is RITTER.ALAN88@gmail.com. I'm on Facebook, Alan Ritter. My website for the Produce Club, which is in the greater Philadelphia area, is produceclub.us. And as always, more fertility and more diversity and more soil biota and more options of choices in your mind is what an emerging forest is all about. And that's why Leslie's been on the show tonight. And it's just the continuing theme of what we do here. So have a great week, and I'll see you next Sunday. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. Join us 7 nights a week for exciting programming covering a variety of expressions of faith. And remember, all manifestations of the divine are equally valid.